Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined today by Paul Carcaterra, a man who needs no introduction, because if you know who I am, if you know what the Inside Lacrosse podcast is, you certainly know who the ESPN commentator and overtime host and four quarters host and Syracuse All-American and how many other things in his lacrosse resume I don't even know how I'd be able to describe. Paul, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing today?
I'm good. You forgot dad that has no place in his home and gets treated, from my standards, improperly these days after the quarantine. I think everyone in my house is sick of me.
Very good. Well, we will get to the quarantine. We will talk about the cancellation of the 2020 season, how you coped with it. We'll talk about what's going on this summer. But I wanted to start with what is the most important conversation going on in the United States right now. And it's around the issue of racial justice. And certainly it's a conversation, as I've said many times, that extends beyond the borders of lacrosse, far beyond the borders of lacrosse, and certainly need to provide the important qualifier that you and I as white men can't and don't understand what it is to be black in America. That being said, you and I are people who take our platform seriously and know that if we don't join the conversation, we're doing a disservice. And I want to talk specifically about the post that you made or posted on June 3rd, where you personalized it to the extent that you can. And I think it's an important approach. And I think that there were a couple of takeaways that I had. So the first is you credited your father, Lawrence, who was a teacher in the Bronx, in the South Bronx, for teaching you how to love. And I think that that's an important starting point. And for exposing you to, and your brothers and sisters, the four of you to, people of different colors, races, and religions. But also you cited how important it is to put actions behind it as well as to listen. So my question is, how have you continued to evolve your understanding in the wake of posting that, you know, particularly through things like, say, hosting interviews with Nat St. Laurent and Trevor Baptiste?
Well, I think for me, first and foremost, being a white male, obviously, it's a really difficult time in terms of not understanding what it is to walk in a black man or a black woman's shoes. But I will say this, I've always been comfortable having these conversations because of the post that you referenced and my dad. I mean, my dad was a school teacher in the South Bronx for 32 years in one of the poorest congressional districts in America. Super, super bright guy, always graduated like in the top 10% of all of his classes and got some academic scholarships. And life wasn't easy for him growing up. I mean, he grew up in the projects in the Bronx. My grandfather was a degenerate gambler. So he was really tight with his mom and his sister, never wanted to leave the city. So went to Fordham University on an academic scholarship and wanted to stay in the Bronx and wanted to give back. So he was a school teacher in a really, really tough neighborhood for three decades. And he exposed us to so much as kids. I mean, when I would go to Yankee games, it was with his summer camp. When I would go to the circus as a kid, I would miss school back home in Yorktown and go to the circus with his students and the faculty and staff at PS 118. So I was exposed to a lot. So it was never a situation where I was uncomfortable having these conversations because we had it in our home all the time. He explained to us at a very young age the way that we needed to open up our hearts and the way that we need to have these conversations. So I don't necessarily feel like the last month or so has been challenging for me. It's been more challenging to, I guess, get people to take risks and to take chances to have these conversations if they haven't yet. Because I think a lot of people are afraid to have the conversations, and I understand why they would be. But I think even if you just say, I don't know what to say, someone can help you and navigate you through the conversation. So I think for me, you know, my dad was the key to all of this and exposed my brothers and my sister. My sister married a black man. She has three biracial children. I've had young black males live with me. One by the name of Dwayne Stewart, who stayed with me for 8 summers. Fantastic young man. So proud of him right now. He taught me a lot. I was exposed to so much based on his family life and his culture and just asking questions and having conversations kind of seamlessly over the years and watching him grow to be a 30-year-old male who's a college lacrosse coach right now, with a master's degree, and was able to watch him grow. And I think all of our conversations there, throughout my dad's influence on me, kind of just allowed me to understand the situation, not necessarily make total sense of it right now, because it's such a trying time for so many people, but I'm comfortable having these conversations. I would just kind of really push people to be part of the conversations, even if you don't know what to say. Sometimes just saying, I don't know what to say is better than nothing, because I think people will help you. And I think people will open their hearts and people will expose you to some knowledge and to some understanding, because I think a lot of people right now just feel like, okay, well, everyone's created equal and I don't see black, white. I don't see the difference in cultures and race and religion, but you kind of need to be quite honest with you. You need to understand the history of all of the people who've been oppressed in this country and in the world, to understand that it's okay to see black, white, but you just need to embrace and open up your heart and love those people, regardless of the color of their skin. And I think that's a big difference with a lot of people struggle because they say, oh, I'm not racist or I'm not prejudiced. I don't see black, white, but you really need to see black, white and to understand the history behind it all, I think, to have a better grasp of the way that you want to lead with your heart, if that makes sense.
Very well said. There was one thing that you brought up that I want to dig a little bit deeper on, because to the extent that this is obviously a conversation that does have a connection to lacrosse, one of the elements that I wrote about a couple of weeks ago that I felt like was a little bit underserved within the conversation was the role of black coaches and the volume of black coaches, or the pipeline for players to grow into coaching positions. And I know that it's a complicated issue, particularly when it comes to being a college coach, because it's a street with many intersections, in the sense that you got to get college lacrosse players who want to be college lacrosse coaches. The job of being a college lacrosse coach is not that glamorous, particularly early. And so, you know, for a lot of these black lacrosse players, black college lacrosse players who, you know, graduate and have great opportunities, whether it's, you know, playing and living in different parts of the country where there aren't college lacrosse programs that they'd be able to be a part of or whatever else. So to have such a close relationship with Dwayne and have seen his journey, what is your point of view on the importance and the importance of increased racial diversity among college lacrosse coaches, as well as any type of plan or strategy to promote that?
I think it's so important. Dwayne was at the house and stayed with us a couple of weekends ago, and I had that conversation with him, and I made it a priority to tell him how important his role is now more than ever. Because I also was involved in a podcast with Nat St. Laurent, and this was eye-opening to me too, because here's a man who is a black lacrosse coach coaching at Ohio Northern University. He started that program 6 years ago. They're really doing well. He has 9 or 10 black males playing on his team. He's coaching in the PLL for the Redwoods. They went to the championship last year. So I'll ask you this question, Terry. If you're a college lacrosse coach that started a program and that has had success in terms of just what you've done in the community and the student athletes' ability to really blossom in the classroom and win lacrosse games, and you're a PLL coach, like, to you, do you feel like if you can win at the PLL and you can start a program at Ohio Northern and coach the best players in the world in the summer and understand what it takes to be a college lacrosse coach, to me, I feel like Nat St. Laurent, when the next big head job comes up, like, why wouldn't he be a candidate? Why wouldn't he be a candidate? Because we talk about how everyone talks about how the sport needs to look different and you can't have one or two black males on a team and really feel like you're moving in a direction where the game is becoming more diverse and we can embrace all these young programs, but we can't see it at the highest level, whether it's Division III, Division I, Division II. Like, to me, you need to have leadership that represent what you want it to look like on the field. So like when the next big head job opens up in Division I, Nat St. Laurent to me has to be a candidate. Like you have to put a person like him in a position to lead a group of young men when he's doing that now. And he has it more reflective on what we want the sport to look like already at Ohio Northern. So like, to me, I think, you know, to have Dwayne in a position right now, who's coaching at SUNY New Paltz, and he's recruiting young black males, and whether he stays there or he goes to another school down the road, like that's going to be a priority for him. It's going to be a priority for Nat St. Laurent. And there's so many more young black males and black females playing the sport of lacrosse right now. My brother Brian and I are heavily involved in Bronx lacrosse. And the biggest issue to me is, you know, you have these programs like Bronx lacrosse, and you have these programs like Harlem and Charm City, and they're fantastic programs. And there can be some horsepower behind the funding of these programs, but we now have to bridge these young players and give them opportunities in the college ranks. And I feel like the more that we have opportunities with guys like Nat St. Laurent or Dwayne Stewart, the better we have to show the sport is moving in a direction that on the field is more diverse.
I couldn't have said it better. I mean, to me, it is the cascading effects, right? It's role models, it's talent selection, and it's intentionality around this. You know, I look at it not simply through an athletic director's responsibility to identify Nat as a candidate, and he has been candidate for high-profile jobs in the last 2 years. And one quick caveat on that, I was talking to one of his colleagues, and he pointed out, look at the percentage of black head coaches in Division II, well, Division I, II, and III, but specifically Division II and III, but certainly Lloyd Carter deserves a piece of this conversation as well. And look at how many of them have started the program that they are coaching. Basically, the implication being, if I want to be a head coach, I need to start a program. That's a pretty heavy burden for yes. any aspiring black coach.
Tremendous.
But that being said, I also think that, you know, there's the natural pipeline as well. It's incumbent on current college coaches, who are the ones that hire their assistants and their volunteers, to identify upcoming talent and cultivate that talent and try to improve the opportunity, the quality of the opportunity. One of the things that I think is really interesting, and I talked to an administrator about this last week, is the role of the graduate assistant. And in other sports, football and basketball, there are, you know, numerous grad assistant opportunities all across the country. The problem is that they're very expensive. They tend to be considerably more expensive than a full-time employee, especially at a private school. And so the likelihood of seeing a preponderance of grad assist jobs being created is very slim. But the reason that's important is because if you're a grad assistant and you're still in school, then you can apply for student loans to cover your housing and meals in a way that you can't if you're simply a volunteer assistant. And so that volunteer assistant that tends to be the first job that every Division I coach has, well, it's pretty outside of reach for, you know, many members of minority populations that don't come from family situations that can help support them if they're going to work essentially for free for a year, two, or more.
Yeah, look, I think you hit on a couple things. One, you don't just wake up one day and become Nat St. Laurent and you're a candidate for these big jobs. You need to groom the coaches, and you need to really put some resources behind them and really give them opportunities to move up the ranks. The volunteer position is a tricky one, because although it's unpaid, and you know better than anyone, I mean, it's paid in a lot of respects as well. I mean, some of these bigger schools are able to pay them by camps, and a lot of these volunteer coaches are on the road and can have a whole summer circuit involved where they're paid at all these different events. So there are ways, and there's creative ways to get the volunteer coaches paid. I mean, some of them are paid in some respect higher than other programs have paid assistants. Like if you look at the discrepancy in terms of some of the bigger schools are able to find ways, and they're creative in terms of just putting those coaches out on the road to get them paid more than some lower level athletic departments paying their second assistant. I mean, that's the reality of it. So you got to be creative about it. But at the end of the day, it really comes down to getting behind the coaches once they get out of college. And, you know, if you have an opportunity where there's a young black male or young black female who's interested in coaching, you have to push them just like you'd push anyone right out of college to get involved in the game, and then have them grow into leadership roles. And once they grow into leadership roles, whether they're a Nat St. Laurent who started the program, to your point, or Dwayne Stewart who started the program, yeah, to your point. So that is a really, really tough ask. As much as Dwayne is thrilled about coaching at SUNY New Paltz, I mean, there are a lot of hurdles he's facing as a first time program, right? Like, and he doesn't have the resources and the bandwidth of a lot of the other programs out there. So it all comes down to getting behind this at the earlier stages of coaching. It's not a quick fix now to say like, okay, now we need to hire black coaches. Like, you have to start at the bottom in terms of really having a process and a system in place where it can happen naturally for many, many years to come, if that makes sense.
Right on, Kark. You and I are very much in agreement. Let's go back to March, though, because I want to get to some fun stuff, or maybe not so fun, but, you know, at least some on-field kind of related things. I asked Mike Diggs this because he's kind of a super fan, and I wanted his perspective. Do you wish the season had never started so that we didn't get teased with like 5-6 games of what could have been, but ultimately never got the payoff? Or are you grateful for the little bit of 2020 that we were able to see?
Unequivocally grateful for the little bit of 2020 that I was able to see. It's like, look, anytime that you love something in life, the pain of when it goes away is more, right? So I would love to always be able to feel that, if it makes any sense. Like the feeling of love kind of reflects the feeling of loss, if that makes any sense. So for me, whether it's people in life or if it's a sport that I'm attached to, like lacrosse, to feel that love for however long it might be, the loss obviously is a lot more profound. But I'm the type of person, honestly, that when I feel pain and I feel loss, regardless of what it is in life, and in this case, it's the sport of lacrosse, the pain is a lot on the back end. But when you have that pain, it means that you love something a lot. So like, I would always shift on the side of feeling really hard loss, because feeling really hard loss means you love something. So lacrosse is a love of mine. I'll take it any day, even though if the back end of it means some pain and missing out on opportunities.
So how do you envision this season would have played out? Who would have won the Thornton? Who would have won the championship?
The championship, I have no clue. I'm not even going to sit here and say, like, you know, this game for sure, or this one or two teams for sure. I think there was four or five teams in the mix, all very intriguing. I think the Thornton was going to be Michael Sauer's, hands down. I mean, what he was doing on the biggest stage early in the season gave him the street cred, I think, that people could get behind easily. And, you know, Grant Ament and Mac O'Keefe at Penn State were intriguing players and an unbelievable, terrific 1-2 punch that the sport of lacrosse typically doesn't see every year. Like, you see two good guys on a team and two great guys on a team a lot, but that mesh and play so well off each other. I mean, you have like the best passer in the game and one of the best passers of all time in Grant Ament, who's a righty who plays behind the cage, to one of the best shooters, in the sport, and one of the great shooters of all time in Mac O'Keefe. And he's a lefty. So like, they played off each other so well. But what I saw from Sauer's and what he did in Charlottesville, playing against the defending national champion in the University of Virginia, and what he did against Hopkins on TV, and just what he was doing early in the season, scoring 13 points in a game. And just like, he was on another level, honestly. And as good as Princeton might have been, and the supporting cast was better than some years past, let's be honest. I mean, he was he was a marked man from the second he got off the bus. I mean, there was a plan and there were slides to him that you don't see all the time. I mean, you saw it with Pat Spencer the year before. You see it with a Lyle Thompson. You see it with a Mikey Powell. But the best player on a team like Princeton gets a little bit more attention than the best player on a team like Virginia or Duke. And I mean this in the last like 10 years. Obviously, Princeton, when they went through their dynasty, was a different story. But Princeton, let's be honest, in the last 10 years hasn't been the Princeton that we knew in the 90s and the 2000s. So I feel like when you have a player like Sowers who's doing that much damage on a team that wasn't even ranked in the top 20 in some polls early in the season, you get different kind of attention, and he answered the bell. So when you get different kind of attention and you answer the bell, you're more of an outlier in my mind.
And now he's transferring to Duke. So turning the attention forward, the amount of news that has unfolded in the sport in the last 3 months has been remarkable. Certainly, it I think is headlined by the season's cancellation, the awarding by the NCAA of an additional year of eligibility, the uncertainty at first, and then a little bit of cloudiness subsequently around how the Ivy League institutions, which, you know, were having historic success this season, were going to handle this additional year of eligibility. And then all the transfers, the collision with transfer portal, both from grad students and from undergrads. It's too much to talk about now, but generally, when you were monitoring it, and maybe philosophically when you think about it, how has this player movement situation changed the landscape of the sport?
Well, it's so hard to really put a finger on it, just from the perspective that I don't think everyone's typically playing by the same rules. And I don't mean that like in a negative connotation. I think like some schools are really, really going to benefit from it on the surface level, but I think it's going to also make the recruiting more challenging as a result, because when you're a desirable like fifth year destination or the transfer portal and you're a great player, gives you opportunities. Look, there's a handful of schools that really have an advantage here, right? But I also think it's going to be challenging on the recruiting front for those schools. And I also think it's going to be challenging on the chemistry of a locker room as well. And I don't think people are talking about that as much. So when you bring in transfers, like, you know, you have kids who were recruited by this school and they played really hard. And typically as a freshman, you get your feet wet and you get acclimated to the program and the school and the culture of the school and the community and the lacrosse program. And then as your sophomore, junior, senior year, you're a contributor on the team. Maybe you're a star. And then all of a sudden, you have some transfers coming in from the portal or they have fifth year opportunities. I think there's going to be a lot of challenges in locker rooms, because when you're a guy who was recruited by a school and you bust your butt and now it's your opportunity, and all of a sudden the school takes an upgrade and they get a guy off the transfer portal, or they get a fifth year player who has an opportunity to go to grad school. That's a challenge from a chemistry standpoint. I don't care what anyone says. It's also a challenge from a recruiting standpoint, because you know when you're a desirable institution for the transfer portal and for the fifth year opportunities for players, that makes recruiting really, really hard for you. Now you're going to say, how does it make it hard? Because you have to anticipate that if an Adler goalie from St. Joe's comes off the portal, or a Sowers comes into the grad school opportunities, you now know that this isn't just a one-year type thing. And I'm using Duke as an example. There's five or six other schools that you could plug in there. It's a challenge recruiting-wise, because how many players do you now take not knowing exactly what's going to happen in a couple years? Because I think a lot of people just assume, like, you know, with the fifth year, all these kids are going to come back and play their fifth year. That's not necessarily the case. Some are going to go, some are just going to say, I had enough of lacrosse. And I think as the years go on, you'll see less and less fifth year players. This year was a real emotional year, Terry. I think a lot of people feel like my senior year was robbed from me. So now I need to go out and play, whether it's at my school or somewhere else. Whereas I think if you're a freshman, sophomore, junior, and you actually play your senior year, you might be more inclined to say, okay, I'm good, I've moved on. But with that said, if you are a desirable school, a lot of players from other schools that have that year, and maybe it's in an Ivy League school, like a kid like Sowers who wanted to go back to Princeton but couldn't. You know, that could be a guy like a Michael Long, depending on what Cornell does with this moving forward. I mean, if that kid's on the market for a fifth year, who's not going to want him? So he goes somewhere else, but that place then has to deal with chemistry issues and also has to deal with recruiting, because I feel strongly about the fact that whether we had a summer of recruiting or not, the 2022s weren't going to be sought after like they were in the past because of what's in front of them in terms of all those spots, if it makes any sense. So I think the 2022s, and you could say with college coaches not going on the road right now and recruiting really hurts the 22s. I don't know how quick they would have been on the 22s anyway. So I think the 22s were going to go into next summer anyway. Now I think they definitely are. Yeah, there's those unicorn type players like Spallina who will get gobbled up the second he can, because he's that good. But I think you're not going to fill your classes regardless. So I think that there's so many trickle down type of effects to this mandate and to the way that the additional year of eligibility will come into play. It really hurts the Ivies. They're going to have to be creative in terms of the way they do things. I wouldn't be surprised if you saw some Ivy League players from Harvard, Yale, or Princeton that take years off, maybe falls off in terms of their academic career, so they can play that extra year and not go somewhere. I wouldn't be surprised if that happened, but I also wouldn't be surprised if you saw the big schools continue to just. When I say the big schools, those traditionally rich programs that everyone would want to go to, and now you have a player maybe that gets looked over throughout the process. Now he has a great career at a place like St. Joe's, and he's an unbelievable goalie. He's going to have opportunities, but he's going to take someone's opportunity to play. And I think recruiting becomes a serious challenge just in terms of how you manage your roster in all those spots.
I was going to ask explicitly about that, but you just answered it. So let me just ask kind of like an emotional question and to a degree give you a little bit of a shout out, which is this past week would have been Maverick Showtime, which is annually one of the premier recruiting destinations in the boys lacrosse calendar. You made the decision to cancel it due to the pandemic. What went into that decision? And to the extent that you talked about love earlier, and I know that this is a huge point of passion, how well do you feel like you know these 22s, and how do you think that for the players who are uncommitted as of, say, February 1 of next spring, their subsequent recruitment is going to follow?
Well, you know, for me, I think to start, canceling the event was emotionally very difficult, but I knew it was the right thing to do. For a couple of reasons. One, we're in a pandemic, and you know, I didn't feel comfortable having that event compromised in terms of just the way that the players would be playing. But more importantly, too, for all the parents that travel in, I mean, we have a really exclusive event. It's a one field model, but a lot of these kids come in from all parts of the country. So to ask parents to get on planes and find hotels to be part of this event, to me, was a really, really tough ask outside of just the safety and the health issues. So I felt like it would have been really, really tough to pull that off with the parents having a really good experience too. Because, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, as much as you want kids to have a great experience, you want to make it easy for the parents. I mean, some of these parents have 3-4 kids and they're traveling all across the country, and the flights now are really compressed, and to get on a plane in the past from Austin, Texas to New York to come to Showtime was a nonstop flight. Now you might be making one or two connections, and the hotels are at half capacity, and they sell out really quickly, and now you're traveling all over the place to get to the event. So like, to me, you got to care about the parents as well too, because They're part of this experience with the players. And then the second part of it was, once the college coaches were not allowed to hit the road because of, you know, the dead period being extended, and no recruiting on the Division I ranks for the duration of potentially the entire summer, at least through August 1st, to me was a no-brainer, just because that was an event. Like I said, it's a one-field model. So we only had that one field going on. And in the past, the college coaches are such a big piece of that, and live scouting and to see the players. And a lot of people said, well, maybe you can move the event and you could have it filmed and send all the video to all the coaches. And, you know, that was an option. But to me, the event, I wanted to keep it the way that it was. And I'm in a little bit different situation. Like, it's the only thing really in the summer that I do lacrosse wise. You know, just, I'm not involved running club lacrosse, or having tournaments across the country. And, you know, it was easy for the group to make that decision because we're pretty lean. It's a one-off event that we do. And, you know, we don't have, you know, 25 full-time employees that we need to hit a bottom line and to make sure that they're taken care of. So being lean in this case was definitely an advantage. But emotionally, no questions asked. I mean, for me, like I said, it's the only event that I'm involved in the summer. So like, I spend all day on the fields, literally from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. I'm on the turf. When the lights are on at night, I'm with the kids. I hang out. I watch all the games. I get to know these kids a lot. And it's really cool for me, too, because so many of these great players in the Division I ranks, regardless of where they're from, have attended Maverick Showtime. So I know their styles. I know what type of kids they are. And I keep in touch with a lot of the kids, too. I mean, I've developed a lot of great relationships with these guys. You know, some of them will DM me on Instagram or Twitter. And, you know, I've relationships in terms of just following them, and they'll send me their highlight tapes and when they're really proud. And so it's super cool on that front. But what we decided to do, and to get a step ahead of it, so in the past we were a one field model for rising freshmen, rising sophomores, and rising juniors. But because of the pandemic and understanding that this summer will not be normal for these players, we decided to push everything back and to guarantee the spots of the players who are enrolled. And next year we will be rising sophomore, rising junior, rising senior for the first time, just because we feel like those players need that opportunity to be seen. So if you're a 22 and you were a rising junior this year, the 22s will be the rising seniors at Maverick Showtime. And I feel like it was just much needed, just because those kids are being deprived an opportunity to play. So we kind of adjusted, and we're a little bit nimble in terms of our decision moving forward, just because of what the anticipation will be. But that 22 class is pretty legit. I mean, I mentioned, you know, Spallina from Long Island, Joey Spallina. He's been at our event the last couple of years, and there's players at his level, a very small elite group at his level, but I feel like this is a class that is really, really strong.
We're up against it time-wise, so unfortunately I'm not going to be able to ask you about four quarters and overtime like I was planning to. We'll save that for the next time we can get you on the podcast. The last thing I want to ask about is the PLL Championship Series, which is set to start on July 25th, and earlier this week, William Hill, the sports betting book, released championship futures odds, basically odds on all seven teams to win the championship. What are your thoughts on this quarantine model that's set to take place outside of Salt Lake City and the prospect of legally being able to bet on pro lacrosse in a meaningful way?
Well, I think, you know, gambling gives any fan an opportunity to feel like they have a little skin in the game. Gambling's never been my cup of tea. I mentioned earlier in this podcast, I'm a little scarred from it from a, you know, emotional standpoint. My father grew up with a degenerate gambler, but I understand the need for gambling in sports, and it's a opportunity for players or fans for that matter to really get behind it and to have that extra interest in the sport. For me, I think, you know, the quarantine model is awesome. I think the PLL has done a tremendous job. I mean, in year two, what they've done and the way they've rolled out all the content and the way they've gotten fan engagement has been spectacular. So pulling this quarantine model off, if any league's going to be able to do it, it's the PLL. I think there's going to be tremendous interest. I think the gambling just also gives, I think, the PLL and lacrosse as a whole, it puts them on a different type of platform, because you know better than anyone, it's not easy to get these deals from a gambling perspective. So it's only going to help the exposure of the sport. It's only going to get fans more engaged and behind players. And I think the way that the PLL rolls out all their content, even if you're just the lukewarm lacrosse fan, I think that you're going to have a lot of stuff at your disposal, maybe that you don't have in some other leagues, just really getting a really deep snapshot of who the players are, who the teams are. If you follow them on social media, I think you can have like a strong connection on a personal level to make your bets even more personal, if that makes any sense. But I think the PLL and the quarantine model like is going to be tremendous. But for me, if you are a gambler and I'm not, it makes it really challenging, because this is year two of a league that now has an expansion team. The expansion team has players from the six original teams on their roster. So those rosters got whittled down, and there's different types of roles for the existing six teams now, and who the players are and what they do for those teams. So if you are a gambler, I think it's going to be a pretty challenging bet, if you ask me, just because you have an expansion team in the Water Dogs, but you have the six existing teams, and none of them look exactly the same that they did a year before. So you really got to do your research, I would recommend.
Well, Paul, this has been great. It's been far too long. We missed hearing you on Saturdays throughout the spring, and no more so than on Memorial Day weekend, when we all should have been at Lincoln Financial Field. But we appreciate your time. We appreciate all that you've done in terms of producing content to satisfy lacrosse fans over the course of the last couple months. And we look forward to crossing paths at a lacrosse game again soon.
Well, Terry, I thank you, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart. You are a fantastic ambassador for the sport of lacrosse, and I don't say that lightly.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. Have a great rest of your day, and we will talk again soon.
Be well.